And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is September the 16th, 259th day of the year. 106 days remain till the year's over with. On this day in 681, Pope Honorius I is posthumously excommunicated by the Sixth Ecumenical Council. Even God's spokesman can be thrown out of the church. 1400, Owain Glyndwr is declared Prince of Wales by his followers. Now, his followers may have declared him Prince of Wales, but what did the king say about that? 1620, Pilgrim set sail from England on the Mayflower, which was partially financed by some of my ancestors. Never got repaid, by the way. 1701, James Francis Edward Stuart, sometimes called the Old Pretender, becomes the Jacobite claimant to the thrones of England and Scotland. A pretender to the throne is someone who claims to be an heir, but may or may not be. 1732, in Campo Maior, Portugal, a storm hits the armory and a violent explosion ensues, kills two-thirds of its inhabitants. That wasn't a good thing. 1776, American Revolutionary War, the Battle of Harlem Heights is fought. Now, this was during the New York and New Jersey campaign. Actually took place in what's now the Morningside Heights area in east end of the future Harlem neighborhoods of northwestern Manhattan Island and what's now part of New York City. Continental Army under the Commander-in-Chief George Washington and Major General Nathaniel Greene and Major General Israel Putnam, they had about 9,000 men, held a series of high ground positions in Upper Manhattan. Opposite them was the vanguard of the British Army, which the vanguard by itself totaled 5,000, under the command of Major General Henry Clinton. Well, patrols of Knowlton's Rangers and the British Light Infantry pickets got into a running firefight as the British chased the Americans back through the woods to Washington's positions on Harlem Heights. Now, the British troops, being called the finest infantry in the world, were kind of overconfident, and they advanced too far from their lines without any support, and they were exposed to counterattack. Seeing this, Washington ordered a flanking maneuver that failed to cut off the British force, but in the face of this attack and pressure from other troops moving from the Harlem Heights position, the British retreated. Well, joining some reinforcements from the south, with the added support of a pair of field pieces, the right infantry turned and made a stand in an open field. The American forces also reinforced, attacked, and it was a lengthy exchange of fire. After 2 hours, with ammunition running short, the British force began to pull back. Washington did not pursue. He didn't want to get into a general engagement with the British main force. But the battle did restore the confidence of the Continental Army after they had suffered several defeats. And it was Washington's very first battlefield success during the American Revolution. 1779, American Revolutionary War. The Franco-American siege of Savannah begins. The French were helping us by that time. 1810, with the Grito de Dolores, Father Miguel Hidalgo begins America's fight for Mexico's fight for independence from Spain. Remember yesterday I talked about the Cry of Dolores, which was Father Miguel Hidalgo who rang the bells and began the fight for independence. 1863, Robert College in Istanbul, the first American educational institution outside the U.S., is founded by Christopher Robert, an American philanthropist. Couldn't spend the money at home, had to take it elsewhere. 1880, the Cornell Daily Sun prints its first issue in Ithaca, New York. The Sun is actually the U.S.'s oldest continuously independent college newspaper, daily newspaper at that. 1893, settlers make a land run for prime land in the Cherokee Strip in Oklahoma. That was the famous land rush that's seen in a lot of westerns people ride hell for leather to the west to get the best land they could. 1908, the General Motors Corporation is founded. That's GMC, don't you know? 1914, World War I, the siege of Brzezinski, present-day Poland, begins. 1920, the Wall Street bombing. A bomb located in a horse wagon explodes in front of a J.P. Morgan building in New York City. Killed 38 and injured 400. I don't know. Now, the bombing was never solved, but investigators and historians believe it was carried out by Italian anarchists. That was a group responsible for a series of bombings the year before. The attack was related to post-war social unrest, labor struggles, anti-capitalist agitation in the U.S. The Wall Street bomb killed more people than the 1910 bombing of the Los Angeles Times, which was the deadliest act of terrorism on U.S. soil up to that point. Of course, now the deadliest act of terrorism is Twin Towers, 9/11. 1940, World War II, Italian troops conquer city Barani, which was amazing. They conquered anything. When they attacked Ethiopia, they were almost beaten by natives on horseback with spears. 1943, World War II, German 10th Army reports it can no longer contain the Allied bridgehead around Salerno. 1945, World War II, the Japanese occupation of Hong Kong comes to an end. 1955, the military coup to unseat President Juan Perón of Argentina is launched at midnight on this date. 1955, a Zulu-class submarine becomes the first to launch a ballistic missile. 1956, the TCN-9 Sydney is the first Australian television station to commence regular broadcast. 1959, the first successful photocopier, the Xerox 914, is introduced in a demonstration on live TV from New York City. Now, that, of course, was a major coup, if you will, for a television station to show a Xerox machine. 1961, United States National Hurricane Research Project drops 8 cylinders of silver iodide into the eye wall of Hurricane Esther. It reduces wind speed by 10%, and that gave rise to Project Storm Fury. And Storm Fury was an attempt to weaken tropical cyclones by flying aircraft into them and seeding the clouds with silver iodide. That project ran from 1962 to 1983. The idea was silver iodide would cause supercooled water in the storm to freeze and disrupt the inner structure of the hurricane. And this led to seeding several Atlantic hurricanes. But it was later shown the idea was actually incorrect. It was determined most hurricanes don't contain enough supercooled water for cloud seeding to be effective. And additionally, researchers found that unseeded hurricanes often undergo the same structural changes that were expected from seeded hurricanes. So this finding called Storm Fury successes into question because it was now a natural explanation. The idea originally originated with some ivory tower scientists who said, you go fly into the hurricane and drop this stuff and it's going to make everything all better. The last experimental flight was flown in 1971 due to a lack of candidate storms and a changeover in Noah's fleet. So you file that one under, you can't win them all. 1961, Typhoon Nancy, with possibly the strongest winds ever measured in a tropical cyclone, makes landfall in Osaka, Japan. 173 people are killed. 1961, Pakistan establishes its Space and Upper Atmosphere Research Commission with Abdus Salam as its head. 1963, Malaysia is formed from the Federation of Malaya, Singapore, North Borneo, and Sarawak. But Singapore is soon expelled from this new country. We don't want those type here, was the attitude. 1966, the Metropolitan Opera House opens at Lincoln Center in New York City with the world premiere of Samuel Barber's opera, Antony and Cleopatra. 1970, King Hussein of Jordan declares war against the Palestinian Liberation Organization. This conflict became known as Black September. And it was actually a battle between the Jordanian Armed Forces and the Palestinian, the PLO, under the leadership of Yasser Arafat. After Jordan lost control of the West Bank to Israel in 1967, Palestinian fighters known as Fedayeen moved their bases to Jordan and stepped up their attacks on the Israel and occupied territories. When Israeli retaliation on the PLO camp based in Karameh, a Jordanian town along the border with the West Bank, developed into a full-scale battle. The perceived joint Jordanian-Palestinian victory against Israel during the 68 Battle of Karameh led to an upsurge in Arab support for the Fedayeen in Georgia and Jordan, and both new recruits and financial aid. But the problem was the PLO got too big britches and called for the overthrow of the Hashemite monarchy that was ruling Jordan. It was basically a state within a state, and the king could not allow that to continue. In 1975, Papua New Guinea gained independence from Australia. 1975, Cape Verde, Mozambique, and Sao Tome and Principe joined the United Nations. 1975, the first prototype of the Mikoyan MiG-31 interceptor makes its maiden flight. 1976, Armenian champion swimmer Savarash Karapetyan saves 20 people from a trolley bus that had fallen into a Yerevan reservoir. 1978, the 7.4 Tabas earthquake affects the city of Tabas in Iran. Had a maximum Mercalli intensity of 9, which is considered violent. 15,000 people were killed. 1979, 8 people escaped from East Germany to the West in a homemade hot air balloon. 1982, Lebanon War. The Sabra and the Shatila massacre in Lebanon takes place. This was the killing of between 460 and 3,500 civilians, mostly Palestinians and Lebanese Shiites, by a militia close to the Kataib Party, also called the Falange, predominantly Christian Lebanese right-wing party. It took place in the Sabra neighborhood and the adjacent Shatila refugee camp in Beirut. From about 6 in the evening on September 16th to 8 o'clock in the morning on September 18th, a widespread massacre was carried out by the militia in plain sight of the Israeli Defense Force, which was its supposed ally. Well, best laid plans, so to speak. 1987, the Montreal Protocol signed to protect the ozone layer from depletion. 1990, the railroad between the People's Republic of China and Kazakhstan is completed at Duskik, adding a sizable link to the concept of the Eurasian land bridge. 1992, the trial of the deposed Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega ends in the U.S. with a 40-year sentence for drug trafficking and money laundering. It's interesting. We went into another sovereign country, kidnapped its president, and put him on trial. Black Wednesday. The British pound is forced out of the European exchange rate mechanism by currency speculators and is forced to devalue against the German mark. 1994, the British government lifts the broadcasting ban imposed against members of Sinn Féin and the Irish paramilitary groups in 1988. 2004, Hurricane Ivan makes landfall in Gulf Shores, Alabama. It was a Category 3 hurricane. 2005, the Camorra organized crime boss, Paolo Di Loro, is arrested in Naples, Italy. Now, for those that aren't really familiar with the Camorra, it's a criminal organization and criminal secret society originating in the region of Campania. It's one of the oldest and largest criminal organizations in Italy. It dates from the 17th century. And unlike the pyramidal structure of the Sicilian Mafia, the Camorra's organizational structure is divided into individual groups, also called clans. Every boss is the head of a clan, in which there may be tens or hundreds of affiliates, depending on the clan's power and structure. Consequently, the Camorra clans act independently, and they're quite a quite prone to feuding among themselves. The Comoras' main businesses seem to be drug trafficking, racketeering, counterfeiting, and money laundering. And it's not unusual for Comora clans to infiltrate politics of their respective areas. You can have a highly placed politician actually being a Comora boss. Okay, 2007, 12 Go Airlines, Flight 269, carrying 128 crew and passengers, crashes in Thailand, killed 89 of the people on board. 2007, security guards working for Blackwater Worldwide shoot and kill 17 Iraqis in Nasser Square in Baghdad. Blackwater was, may still be, a contractor for the U.S. government. 2013, a gunman kills 12 people at the Washington Navy Yard. 2014, Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant launches its Kobani offensive against Syrian Kurdish forces. And in 2019, 5 months before the COVID-19 stock market crash, an overnight spike in lending rates in the U.S. prompts the Federal Reserve to conduct operations in the repo market. Well, there's a lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Far too many to go into. And most of them wouldn't mean anything to most of the listeners anyway. Holidays and observances, Christian Feast Day, Andrew Kim Taegon, one of the Korean martyrs. Kirkodomus, Cyprian in the Catholic Church. Edith of Wilton, Euphemia, Udmilla, Ninian, Pope Cornelius. The Cry of Dolores celebrates the Declaration of Independence of Mexico from Spain in 1810. Independence Day in the Papua New Guinea celebrates independence of Papua New Guinea from Australia in 1975. International Day for the Preservation of the Ozone Layer. Malaysian Armed Forces Day in Malaysia. Malaysia Day in Malaysia and Singapore. Martyrs Day in Libya. And National Heroes Day in St. Kitts and Nevis. Okay, let's see what else we got. In 1575, King John Casimir of Paltz promises military aid to the Huguenots. 1597, French troops chase away Albrecht of Austria. When the Mayflower left Plymouth, England in 1620, it had on board 100 true pilgrims and 30 crew, heading for the New World. In 1630, the Massachusetts village of Shawmut changes its name to Boston. You may have heard of it. 1652, Spanish troops occupy Dunkirk. 1654, Russian troops occupy Smolensk in Poland. 1688, King John II Casimir of Poland resigns and flees to France. 1702, Emperor Leopold I declares war on France, Cologne, and Bavaria. In 1782, the Great Seal of the United States of America is used for the first time. The design was supposedly given to one of the founding fathers by a strange figure he met in his own garden. 1795, the British captured Cape Town, South Africa from the Dutch. 1830, on this date, Oliver Wendell Holmes writes a poem, Old Ironsides, as tribute to the 18th century USS Constitution. This day in 1847, Shakespeare's Birthplace Trust buys the Bard's birthplace in Stratford-upon-Avon. Now, we still don't have any definitive proof he actually was a real person. 1848, slavery was abolished on this date in all French territories. 1857, the issuance of the Mexican Constitution of Force, which fiercely was attacked by Pope Pius IX. 1858, the first overland mail to California took place on this date. 1859, Lake Nyasa, which forms Malawi's boundary with Tanzania and Mozambique, was first discovered by British explorer David Livingstone. He was a physician and an explorer. and gave rise to those famous words, Dr. Livingstone, I presume. 1861, Battle of Princeton, West Virginia. 1861, the British Post Office Savings Banks were opened. 1862, General Braxton Bragg's Confederate Army surrounds 4,000 Federals at Munfordville in Kentucky. 1873, German troops leave France. 1901, Alturas, California is incorporated as the only city in Modoc County in California. 1906, Douglas Mawson, Edgeworth David, and Alastair McKay claim to have discovered the magnetic South Pole in Antarctica. Now you gotta ask yourself, did they really do it? There was a lot of question. Well, and finally in 1922 on this date, the Turkish troops chased the Greeks completely out of Asia. Well, we have finished our little history segment for today. We're going to see what else we can find to talk about. You know, we were talking yesterday about a Haitian man who claimed he was actually a zombie. Now, there's a lot of discussion about whether zombies are real. There's been a lot of stories that have come out of Haiti and Louisiana about individuals that you might describe as zombies working in, as virtual slaves for a Bokor, which is a voodoo practitioner. Let's talk about whether or not mummy curses are real. You know, hexes have been found at more than 100 burial sites in the Egyptian city of the dead. And there's been a lot of discussion about, for example, King Tut's tomb. You know, more than 4,000 years ago, a high-ranking official named Akhmohor was laid to rest in an above-ground tomb in Saqqara, Egypt's ancient city of the dead. It's actually 20 miles south of Cairo. And inscribed on the walls of the tomb is an ominous message threatening any impure intruders with a fear of seeing ghosts and warning that any damage to the tomb will be paid back to the intruders' own property. Well, so far, this particular curse has yet to affect archaeologists who uncovered this tomb and more than 100 others in 2020. The coffins serve as tiny houses for the afterlife with no expenses spared, decorated with scenes the deceased would want to experience in eternity. Salima Ikram, an Egyptologist at the American University in Cairo, said, "You want to have a fabulous afterlife, so you had a fabulous tomb." He talked about that in the Netflix documentary, Secrets of the Saqqara Tomb. Now, the dead are said to be protected by the court of underworld Lord Osiris, who metes out punishment ranging from beatings and the severing of a nose up to the penalty of death for desecrating a royal tomb. That's the sort of curse that supposedly was ascribed to the tomb of King Tutankhamun. 4 months after Lord Carnarvon became the first person in modern times to enter Tut's tomb in 1922, he was dead. And at the time of his death, his favorite dog began to howl and then dropped over dead in England. Now, the official cause of Lord Carnarvon's death was blood poisoning from an infected mosquito bite. But that's as far-fetched as claiming that it was the curse of the mummy. Arthur Conan Doyle, the author, suggests it was really elementals in the tomb created by Tut's priest to protect their king. Howard Carter, who was the leader of the Tut expedition, would live for another 20 years and always described the idea of a tomb curse as Tommy Rot. However, quite a number of people who were involved in that initial excavation did die under strange circumstances. Now, most mummy curses are actually found near tombs from the Old Kingdom, which went from 2575 BC to 2150 BC. King Tut, who ruled during the New Kingdom about 1,000 years later, didn't actually have any curses written near his tomb. Of course, the Egyptian priests were far more sophisticated, we give them credit for. They may have used their version of poison, airborne poison. We do the same thing today. We just don't call it a curse. Well, the FBI, which the CIA calls the Cabbage Patch Kids, which ignores actual criminal activity in favor of looking into things that can't hurt them, actually did a Bigfoot investigation. It analyzed hair samples retrieved after a Sasquatch sighting. Now, if you want to rob a bank, you want to violate the civil rights of all kinds of people, that's fine. FBI's not going to oppose you. Now, the FBI gets its share crackpot request, and this one would seem to have been one of the craziest of all. It happened in 1976 when a Bigfoot researcher submitted 15 hairs on a piece of skin and asked if the agency could analyze it to determine whether it came from the legendary ape-like creature of the Northwest known as Bigfoot or Sasquatch. You know, rather than toss that request out, the FBI actually replied to Peter Byrne, director of the Bigfoot Information Center. It normally only conducted such tests on crime scene evidence, except in rare exceptions. But they were going to make an exception in this case. Now, why America's leading criminal investigative body? Self-proclaimed, of course. Took his request seriously remains a mystery to this day. Perhaps the feds became as swept up in Bigfoot mania as everybody else. During the 1970s, of course, there were books and TV shows and movies about the mysterious creature reported to have left big tracks in the mud in the 50s and seen striding through the woods in an infamous 67 home movie. He'd retrieved the tuft of hair and skin snagged on the bark of a tree near where two witnesses said they had seen some kind of strange large animal walking. In a letter to the FBI, Byrne stressed, please understand, our research here is serious. This is a serious question and he's answering. Well, 40 years went by and he didn't hear a thing from the FBI. Then in 2019, when he was 93 years old, the FBI declassified its Bigfoot file. Apparently, it had been considered top secret up to that point. The agency confirmed it had, in fact, tested the hairs in 1977 and found they did not come from Bigfoot. The report said they came from the deer family. Well, this was, of course, another blow to the study of Bigfoot, coming after the revelation that those mud tracks were part of a hoax and strong indications that the home movie is really a guy in an ape suit. Now, of course, keep in mind, there are many, many people who want to take credit for doing things like that, but that doesn't mean that, in fact, they're telling the truth. Well, there's an Israeli town that apparently has too much money. It's offered $1 million for a mermaid photo. Mermaid is said to be swimming off the coast of a Mediterranean village. Well, the idea of a mermaid may sound a little strange to most folks. According to the local people, she's initially quite shy, only appearing at sunset just off the coast of the Israeli town of Kiryat Yam. But once she gets comfortable with your presence, she'll put on quite a show. And if anybody could get a photograph of her, as I said, they've offered $1 million for that photo. Now, a mermaid frolicking in the Mediterranean has actually mesmerized the local residents, who are mostly Russian and Ethiopian immigrants. And this has been the case for years, with many sightings of the sea creature that witnesses say looks to be half girl, half dolphin, have been reported. According to Nati Zimmerman, a local council spokesperson for the town, people are telling us that they're sure they've seen the mermaid. And each of these people is independent from the others. They don't seem to be in any collusion. And the town is, as I said, offered $1 million cash prize for any visitor who can get a picture of this elusive mermaid. One witness, Shlomo Cohen, said, "I was with friends when suddenly we saw a woman laying on the sand in a weird way." This was on the website Live Science. "First, we thought it was just another sunbather, but when we approached, she jumped into the water and disappeared. And that's when we all got the shock of our lives because she had a fish tail." Now, mermaids have been the stuff of seafaring legends since ancient times. Mesopotamian artwork from 1800 BC depicts entities with human bodies and fish tails. Usually they're mermen. Stories of mermaids first appeared in Assyria in about 1000 BC. And mariners have reported spotting half-naked mermaids for generations. Now, scientists have suggested witnesses actually mistook manatees and other aquatic animals for mermaids, or were just letting their imaginations run wild, but those scientists are ivory tower scientists who are not there themselves. They sit in their nice air-conditioned offices and pontificate on what all the mistakes non-scientists are making. The 19th century Fiji mermaid exhibit by circus man P.T. Berman was a hoax, and in Israel, the $1 million photo bounty is admittedly a gimmick to boost tourism. First offered in 2009, but so far there has not been any pictures that have emerged showing this elusive mermaid. According to an interview given to ABC News, if there really is a mermaid, then so many people come to Kiryat Yan, and a lot more money than that $1 million will be made by the locals. And certainly, they want to boost tourism, certainly. Well, there have been a lot of stories about strange creatures. And when you're talking about mermaids and things like that, it's odd that you get people who don't know each other giving the same story. Now, as to the question of whether or not mermaids are real, there's actually not been any definitive evidence found that aquatic humanoids do exist. The ancient Greek epic poet Homer wrote about them in the Odyssey. In the ancient Far East, mermaids were the wives of powerful sea dragons and were trusted messengers between their spouses and the emperors on land. The Aboriginal people of Australia are familiar with them. They call them the Yawk Yawks. That name may refer to their mesmerizing songs. Now, the belief in mermaids may have arisen at the very dawn of the human race. Magical female figures first appear in cave drawings in the late Paleolithic or Stone Age period of 30,000 years ago. That was when modern humans gained dominion over the land and presumably began to sail the seas. Now, half-human creatures called chimeras were found all through mythology. In addition to mermaids, there were wise centaurs, wild satyrs, and frightful minotaurs. That's just a few. But mermaids, well, you got to ask yourself, if there's been no definitive evidence found, why do they continue to occupy the collective consciousness of nearly all seafaring peoples? And of course, that there's never been an answer to that particular question. Now, even though there's been no definitive evidence found outside of folklore, reports of mermaid sightings continue to the present day. And you can find them all through art and literature. Even Hans Christian Andersen in the literary fairy tale The Little Mermaid that became a movie, talked at length about them. Now, there are, of course, many, many stories that had been reported in mainstream media. In fact, there's a documentary that purports to discuss mermaids caught on camera. ABC News aired that and got big ratings. Now, there was a disclaimer at the very end of the credits that called into question the validity of it. There's another story that talked about a dead mermaid found on the beach after a hurricane. On the Animal Planet, there was a film, Mermaids, The Body Found, that talked about that. It was found in 2012. Now, the documentary, which was entitled Mermaids, The Body Found, aired on American TV channel Animal Planet and Discovery Channel back in 2012. And it tells the story of a scientific team's investigative efforts to uncover the source behind mysterious underwater recordings of an unidentified marine body. And the show presents the controversial aquatic ape hypothesis as evidence that mermaids do exist, along with a digitally manufactured video. And then in 2013, a sequel was broadcast called Mermaids, The New Evidence. It's an example of what's known as docufiction, which documentary style and programming elements are combined with fictional, or sometimes, shall we say, speculative science and fiction. And this type of programming gets particular criticism when, as in an original broadcast, there are only a few easily missed disclaimers. Let's think about Orson Welles' War of the Worlds, which was a radio drama that was set up to mimic, if you will, real reports. It had people driving around the countryside with shotguns shooting at water towers. But Mermaids, The Body Found got 1.9 million views during its premiere. It was the network's most watched telecast since the Steve Irwin Memorial Special in September 2006. People want to believe. There's no question about that. And of course, when you're dealing with things such as that, it does raise quite a number of very bizarre questions. Almost as many as when you discuss alien abductions. Now, this is the phenomenon of people reporting what they believe to be the real experience of being kidnapped by extraterrestrial beings and subjected to physical and psychological experimentation. Now, most ivory tower scientists explain these experiences by factors such as suggestibility, or the false memory syndrome, sleep paralysis, deception, and psychopathology. There's one skeptic named Robert Schaefer who sees similarities between aliens depicted in science fiction films and some of the reports of folks who say they were abducted. People claiming to have been abducted are usually called abductees or experiencers. Now, the typical claims involve forced medical examinations and emphasize the subject's reproductive systems. And abductees sometimes claim they've been warned against environmental abuses and the dangers of nuclear weapons, or to have engaged in interspecies breeding. Contents of the abduction narrative often seem to vary with the home culture of the alleged abductees. UFOs, alien abduction, and mind control plots can also be part of radical, political, apocalyptic, and millennium narratives. Now, reports of these alleged abductions have been made all around the world. but the most common seem to be in English-speaking countries, especially the U.S. The most widely publicized alien abduction was the Betty and Barney Hill abduction in 1961. She was the aunt of Kathleen Martin, who I got to know at when I used to speak at Roswell until I became politically unacceptable to the great and all-powerful Don Smith. Now, UFO abductions have claims have declined since their initial surge in the mid-1970s. And alien abduction narratives have found less popularity in the mainstream media, who is so focused on all things evil stem from Donald Trump. The ubiquity of camera phones increases the burden of evidence for these claims and may be a cause of their decline. If you can't get anything to back it up, how do we know you're telling the truth? Now, mainstream scientists, ivory tower scientists in my parlance, reject claims that the phenomenon literally occurs as reported. But there is very little doubt that many apparently stable people who report alien abductions believe their experiences are very real. John Mack, who I got to meet, John Wilson, Rima Lebow, and David Gottlieb assessed that while psychopathology was associated in some cases, most reports are from sane, common people with nothing to gain by making this stuff up. Now, some abduction reports are really quite detailed. An entire subculture is developed around the subject with support groups and a detailed mythos explaining the reason for abductions. The various alien groups, such as Greys, Reptilians, and Nordics, are said to have specific roles, origins, and motivations. Abduction claimants don't always attempt to explain the phenomena, but some take independent research interest in it themselves and explain the lack of greater awareness of alien abduction as a result of either extraterrestrial or government interest in conducting a cover-up. That's where you get the ubiquitous men in black. Now, while the term alien abduction didn't achieve worldwide attention until the 60s, modern speculation about some of the older stories make it appear that they may well have been abductions that were not recognized. Jerome Clark, another UFO researcher, has dubbed these stories paleo abductions. We began with November 27, 1896, in the edition of the Stockton, California Daily Mail. Colonel H.G. Shaw, who used to be the editor of that The Daily Mail, claimed that he and a friend were harassed by three tall, slender humanoids whose bodies were covered with a fine, downy hair who tried to kidnap the pair. They were not successful. In October 1953, issue of Man to Man magazine, an article by Leroy Thorpe titled, "Are the Flying Saucers Kidnapping Humans?" asked the question, "Are an unlucky few of us, and perhaps not so few at that, being captured in the same ease that we would net butterflies? Maybe for zoological specimens? Maybe for vivisection or some other horrible death designed to reveal to our interplanetary invaders what makes us tick?" And then there's the 1955 publication of Harold T. Wilkins' Flying Saucers Uncensored, which declared that Carl Hernrath and Wilbur Wilkinson, who claimed they were contacted by aliens, had disappeared in mysterious circumstances. Wilkins talked about the speculation that the duo were the victims of abduction by flying saucer. Certainly, there's been other stories that raise those same issues. You know, an early alien abduction claim occurred in the mid-50s with the Brazilian Antonio Villas Boas case. Now, that didn't get attention until several years later. He was a farmer in Brazil. And because of the heat in South America, and if you've never been there, you can't understand it, he did a lot of his work in the late evening. And he was plowing his field when he saw this light come in and land right near the edge of the field. Well, he decided, wisely, it was time to be elsewhere, but he discovered he was surrounded. He was grabbed and taken on board the UFO. He was stripped and exposed to a gas that came out of the ventilation system. And then what he described as a rather gorgeous naked alien woman came in. And to a man and a woman being naked, they did what came naturally. And after that, she pointed to him, and pointed to her stomach, and to the sky. And then he was released. But being a Brazilian farmer, and there not being a large number of UFO researchers in Brazil at that point in time, this story did not get a lot of attention until a number of years later. Now, similar stories had circulated for years before this, but his claims are among the first alien abduction stories to get worldwide attention. Now, some skeptics today, usually ivory tower scientists, consider the abduction story to be a little more than a hoax, although he stuck to his account throughout his entire life. At the time this happened, he was 23 years old. He was plowing his fields near São Francisco de Sales when he saw what he described as a red star. He was trying to escape on his tractor, as I said, as happens quite often when our technology comes around a UFO. The lights stopped and the motor quit. And when it was all over, Lois reported that he believed that she was going to raise their child in space, that he had actually impregnated her. He said the female seemed relieved their task, as it were, was over. Lois himself said he felt angered by the situation. He thought he was being treated nothing more than a good stallion for these creatures. He said he was given back his clothing and taken on a tour of the spaceship, and quite often abductees report being shown through the ship. He tried to take something so he could prove his story, but they prevented him from doing so. Then he was escorted off the ship and watched as it took off. He went on to later become a lawyer, married, and had four children. But he stuck to his abduction story until he died in 1992. Of course, as other sources say, he died January 17, 1991. Now, following the incident, he reported to have suffered from nausea and weakness and headaches and lesions on the skin that appeared without any kind of bruising. Eventually, he talked to journalist Jose Martinez, and who placed an ad in a newspaper looking for people that had experience with UFOs. When he heard Boas's story, he contacted Dr. Olavo Fontes of the National School of Medicine in Brazil. Fontes was also in contact with the American UFO Research Group, APRO. Fontes examined the farmer, concluded he had been exposed to a large dose of radiation from some source and was suffering from mild radiation sickness. Well, the story first came to light in February 1958, and the earliest definite print reference to the Boas story was in April of 1962 issue of the Brazilian UFO periodical, SBESDV Bulletin. And, of course, the story had been widely circulated by word of mouth from 58 to 62. Now, Boas was able to recall every detail of his experience without the need for any hypnotic regression, which was a little unusual. And his experience occurred in 57, which is several years before the Betty and Barney Hill abduction, which made the concept of alien abduction famous and opened the door to many other reports. Now, there was an assumption made by many that as a farmer who wasn't highly educated, how did he develop this story with so many details that didn't really come to light until the Betty and Barney Hill abduction in 1961? Now, these two cases, Antonio Villas Boas and Betty and Barney Hill, are viewed as the earliest abductions, but they were only the first abduction cases, and they basically laid out a template that later abductees and researchers would refine but not really deviate from. And purported abductions were cited contemporaneously at least as early as 1954. And that the growth of the abduction stories is a far more tangled affair than the normally accepted official history. Now, Leo Sprinkle, University of Wyoming psychologist, became interested in the abduction phenomenon in the 1960s. And he became convinced of the phenomenon's actuality. and he was the first to suggest a link between abductions and cattle mutilation. He came to believe he had been abducted by aliens in his youth and was forced from his job in 1989 by those who thought he had lost his marbles. Bud Hopkins was another researcher who had become interested in UFOs for years. In the 1970s, he became interested in abduction reports and began using hypnosis to extract more details from these events. He became a figurehead of the growing abductee subculture. Now, the 1980s brought a major degree of mainstream attention to the subject. Works by Bud Hopkins, Whitley Strieber, David Jacobs, psychiatrist John Mack presented alien abductions as a plausible experience. And in the 1980s, there was the publication of folklorist Thomas Bullard's comparative analysis of nearly 300 alleged abductions. Well, with the assistance of Hopkins, Jacobs, Max, and others, accounts of alien abduction became a prominent aspect of ufology. There have been earlier abduction reports that have come to light. Of course, the best known is the Betty and Barney Hill abduction. But they were believed initially to be few and far between and saw rather little attention from the ufologist and even less attention from mainstream professionals. Jacobs and Hopkins argued alien abduction was far more common and had been earlier suspected. They decided that there had been tens of thousands of North Americans who had been abducted by these creatures. Jacobs and Hopkins argued there was an elaborate process underway in which aliens were attempting to create human-alien hybrids, the most advanced stage of which was the human hybridization program, though the motives for this effort are somewhat obscure. There have been anecdotal reports of phantom pregnancy related to UFO encounters at least as early as the 1960s. But Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs were instrumental in popularizing the idea of widespread systematic interbreeding efforts on the part of the aliens. The description of alien encounters as researched and presented by Hopkins and Jacobs and Mack and others were similar with slight differences in each researcher's emphasis. The process of selective citation of abductee interviews that supported these variations was somewhat criticized by ivory tower scientists. Although abductees who presented their own accounts directly fared no better. It's like the discussion of meteors, initially. When people talked about rocks that fell from the sky, ivory tower scientists sneered at him and said, rocks can't fall from the sky because there are no rocks in the sky. Later it was discovered that was not exactly correct. Now the involvement of people like Jacobs and Mack marked something of a change in the abducting studies. The efforts are controversial. Both men saw damage to their professional reputations, but to other observers, these two brought a degree of respectability to the subject. According to the Boston Globe writer Linda Rodriguez McRobbie, abduction and contact stories aren't quite the fodder for daytime talk show and New York Times bestsellers they were a few years ago. Today, credulous stories of alien visitation rarely crack the mainstream media. However much they might thrive on niche TV channels and internet forums. And Michael Shermer has noted that the camera phone age is increasing the burden of evidence on experiencers. Now, according to Matheson, if Jacob's credentials in this field were impressive, those of Harvard psychiatrist John Mack might seem impeccable by comparison. Mack was a well-known, highly esteemed psychiatrist who wrote over 150 scientific articles, and he won the Pulitzer Prize for his biography, T.E. Lawrence. Well, Mack became interested in the phenomenon in the late 80s, interviewing over 800 people, and he wrote two books on the subject. He came to El Paso for a book signing, and Barnes & Noble, which never had an issue before, forgot to order his books. So they had but five or six books for him to sell at his book signing. Now, Mack devoted a substantial amount of time to investigating these cases, eventually concluded the only phenomenon psychiatry adequately explained the patient's symptoms in several of the cases was post-traumatic stress disorder. As he noted at the time, based on his research, this would imply the patients generally believed that the remembered incident had actually occurred, and Mack later came to endorse that position. Now, in June of 1992, Mack and psychiatrist David Pritchard organized a five-day conference at MIT to discuss and debate the abduction phenomena. And that conference, of course, attracted a wide range of professionals representing a variety of perspectives, as well as the usual fruits and nuts. C.D.B. Bryan, a writer, attended the conference, initially intending to gather information for a humorous article for the New York Times, for the New Yorker, rather. While attending the conference, though, his view of the subject changed, and he wrote a serious, open-minded book on the phenomena. He went on to interview many abductees, skeptics, and proponents. Mack's study of numerous cases led him to the conclusion that while investigators should remain open to the possibility of these experiences occurring, stories shouldn't be considered to involve actual physical entities and should be treated like subjective witness reports of personal experience. And certainly, that would be the proper course of action to take. And although abduction and other UFO-related reports are usually made by adults, sometimes young children report similar experiences. And these child reports often feature very specific details in common with reports of abductions made by adults, including the circumstances, the narrative, entities, and the aftermath of the alleged abductions. Often these young abductees have family members who've reported having abduction experiences. And family involvement in the military or residence near a military base is also common among child abduction reports. In a study investigating the motivations of the alleged abductors, Jenny Randalls found that 4 cases out of 50 where the experience was over 40 years of age were rejected by the aliens for what the experience is usually inferred to be a medical reason. Randalls went on to say the abduction is essentially a young person's experience. And given the reproductive focus of the alleged abductions, it is not surprising one man reported being rejected because he had undergone a vasectomy. Well, then we have political scientists getting involved in the mix. Michael Barkin, a political scientist, without taking a position on if UFOs and aliens are real, highlighted links between radical politics and conspiracy theories involving UFOs. He observed the rise of a form of eclectic and apocalyptic millennialism, what he termed improvisational millennialism. UFOs and abduction stories can often be part of stigmatized or suppressed knowledge narratives or alleged is claimed to be maintained in area for nefarious purposes to keep society in ignorance. And of course, UFO and alien-related conspiracy theories emerged in far-right politics from the 1980s on to this day. The popular culture TV shows like The X-Files motion picture not only included aliens as part of cover-up conspiracies, but militias and black helicopters, and also featured demonization of FEMA, a common target of conspiracy theorists, millennium scenarios. One conspiracy theory alleges that FEMA plans to incarcerate patriots suddenly in concentration camps during a disaster. And in fact, there are stories of abandoned federal facilities that have been modernized and brought up to date to be used, allegedly, to incarcerate those that the government deems untrustworthy. Well, on that note, we've come to the end of another show. We'll be back tomorrow when, once again, you'll be listening to Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show. Until then, have a truly great evening.